This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Coyote's twin granddaughters, Answer Woman and Question Woman, landed on a fence rail high atop Sonoma Mountain to chatter away and tell stories, as they have on so many days. Sonoma Mountain has always been a special place for Coast Miwok and Southern Pomo people. It is said that Coyote was sitting atop Sonoma Mountain when he decided to create the world and people. But that is just one story. This is G.P. Gottlieb, host for New Books and Literature, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. And today I'm talking to Greg Saris, PhD and tribal leader serving his 16th term as chairman of the Federated Indians of Grattan Rancheria, about his latest story collection, The Forgetters. The stories are all connected to the two sister crows who sit all day and night on Sonoma Mountain in California. They're telling stories about the creation of the world, human frailty, silliness, and suffering. One crow sister can only ask the questions, but the older sister can only tell the answers in tales about those struggling to remember the stories that made them who they are. Hi, Greg. Thanks for joining me today.
Oh, Galit, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
So how did these stories come to be? Did you base them on traditional stories, or did you sit at your desk, paper or pen in hand, and invent them from scratch?
How about all of the above?
Okay.
So some of the stories actually, well, they're predicated on stories that I've heard and some of the ancient traditional stories. But the book is really a kind of a mix of genres, because I put together a lot of the traditional European forms and mixed it with the indigenous forms to create this series of tales about the Forgetters.
The geography of the northern west coast plays a role in many stories, from Sonoma Mountain to the Tamales Bay to Bodega Bay. Can you say more about the land itself?
Yeah, for indigenous people and for many of us, the landscape had always been a sort of Bible, a sacred text. And of course, so much of it has been compromised. And one of the concerns that I've always in my literature is my writing is, how do we come home? How do we find a place? How do we find ourselves home again? And that is American Indian and non-Indian. And so what I've tried to do with so many stories is restory the landscape, if you will. So you'll notice that each of these stories is located in and about a very specific locale, something that happened there, some story that will remind us of something that we need to remember, something that a story that we can learn from and also understand the landscape. That said, though it's a very specific landscape, that is, of Marin and at Sonoma counties in Northern California, the stories, I think, are universal, as I hope any good writing should be.
The collection is tied together really beautifully by the Crow Sisters. We'll say more about that. And they have a connection to coyote, who's often mentioned in Native American tales that I've read. What can you tell me about the coyote role in Native American stories?
Well, he's central in the coyote has been central in so many American Indian stories, and he's simultaneously a creator. I mean, he creates the world as much as we know it, but he's also somewhat of a fool. He makes mistakes. In the simplest sense, Galit, he represents the human being, the human consciousness. We are smart and we think we can do things, but we often forget that we're not the center of the universe and that we are only a part of the whole. Coyote, even though he does these brilliant things, forgets those things and forget and attempts to control or manipulate his environment, much to his creating his own problems, much like all of us. So he really kind of represents the human consciousness, what it's like to be human. And much of being human is silly and foolish, and we have to remember to stay connected.
Absolutely true. In one of the stories, you mentioned that the Spanish padres left their rancheria to the Indians. But then the American Indians end up working for the Mexicans. Can you explain that?
Here in California, it's a incredible history, and thank you so much again for asking, because so much American Indian literature and in the films and stuff is always Plains Indians, and people don't have much sense of the rich and complicated culture west of the Rockies. But the Spanish first colonized us and had us in the missions, basically enslaved us, and then the Mexicans, after the secularization of the missions and the Revolution of Mexico, the Mexicans came and put us to work basically as indentured servants or slaves on their ranchos, on their large tracts of land that the Mexican government gave certain individuals, generals who had been in the Mexican army. And then, of course, in the first piece of legislation in California, legalized Indian slavery. And so we had been working there. So the stories take place in various times during our history. And one of them, as you just mentioned, is during the time that we were working for the Mexican ranchers. We lost that land, of course. The Spanish lost it to the Mexicans in history, and then the Mexicans lost it to the Americans in the Bear Flag Revolution, when right before California became a state. So we were here all along. And as I like to say, California Indians, we are a barometer of a California history. Everybody who's been here is part of our history, all content.
In one story, a stranger shows up at a camp with five people. This is after California became a state. And the American Indians teach the stranger how to live with them, but then they forget everything that they teach him. What's the lesson here? What did these people need to learn?
A wonderful question, Galit. In that case, it's the danger. What the people needed to do is they were tempted and beguiled by the things, all of the things, and not all the good things that shall we say, the person who came into the landscape, the European in this case, had to offer. And they were offered an easy lifestyle. They were offered ways to get wealth, not to work as hard. And in a way, they bit the bait, and as a consequence, found themselves alienated from the land, from their traditions, and one another. The lesson there is to be careful about who you meet and what you do, and to remember the important things from your culture.
Songs play an important role in the stories. A character will often break into a song. Can you say more about the role of singing in traditional Native American storytelling?
Well, yes, the singing and language and all of those sort of things, songs had power And we saw them much like living things. You would trade songs. They were like kinds of medicine, and they had power. Language had power, and the song was a heightened form of language. So people would have songs for luck, let's say. They would have songs for gambling, songs to placate the salmon, the fish that would be running, and also love songs. So they would try to, you know, put a spell on somebody if you wanted somebody to fall in love with you. So, and songs to, I mean, each of the parts of the earth, the trees, the animals, all had songs associated with them. And we learned those songs and thanked the land for the songs. We asked for favors with the songs. So they were instrumental. Songs and music were instrumental in all of our communications with one another and with the land.
Mm. In the story of the man who followed an osprey, you write that, quote, digger was a nasty word the white people used for Indians. Can you explain that? I'm not familiar with the term or what it was used for.
Yes. What happened is, you know, when the early Americans in particular came here, in the 1850s and began to populate the land, they noticed that we had digging sticks and we would dig for tubers and, as we said, Indian potatoes along the marshes and a lot of roots and things that we ate. So they watched us with sticks and so forth digging. And they saw that as, you know, unlike the Plains Indians, not as sophisticated as being on a horse chasing buffalo. So digger became what they just generally called all California Indians. They thought we were the lowest form of Indian culture. And it was a very derogatory term. And they basically, it came from us, but we did many things besides dig roots. But they saw us doing that. And that term, a very derogatory term, just kind of took over. And they deemed us all diggers, digger Indians.
You also write in the following sentence, quote, the Indians, uncomfortable but long familiar with the white man's derision, no doubt had their own word to describe the river's bend. So my question is, what did it mean for the Indians to be uncomfortable? How did that discomfort manifest?
Well, I think, you know, as with all of us, if the group of people, our people are referred to, and we all know the dirty words that people call one another based on their race, is painful. It reminded us of how they thought about us as second, third, fourth class citizens, and that they didn't see us as fully human. It was essentially as is all words that describe people in a negative way. It's a way of othering people so that they aren't people. They're less than people. And so we knew that. We felt that. The second part of your question is we had our own name for the land because all features of the landscape, all places, Indian people had named the land. One of the great ironies is when, with colonization, they come and name the land as if it didn't, and places in the land as if it hadn't been named already. We had our own names.
Right. You set a story in the hills east of Santa Rosa in the early 1950s. Three people appear to a woman named Isabel. One's Indian, one's Mexican, and one is Irish-German. Why did you choose to include people of other backgrounds in the story, since the stories are trying to remember our Indian culture? What were you thinking?
Thank you again. Great question. Galit, we are all here now, and even Indian people cannot simply look at non-Indians and think we're not human. We are all part of the landscape here, and we must learn to live together so that the people, those three people, who, by the way, were shapeshifters, they could turn into different things, and they were very magical people. It was a reminder for Isabel to think that, wait a minute, I thought this was just about Indian people and just about us, but the stories and the magic of the land and the magic in each and every one of us is about every one of us. And we're all here now together. And again, that's another one of the lessons, or that one of the things that Isabel must learn, that if we see one another as potentially magic and not just as an Indian or Irish or German or Jewish or whatever, we're that and everything more.
That's a beautiful answer. And I wanted to ask about it. I wanted to ask you to address the subject of shapeshifters like these people, and also called Walapus.
Walapu, yeah.
Walapu. Yeah, mm-hmm. Could you talk about that?
Yes, that's another. In California, our religion was predicated on the notion that everything was sacred, and you didn't know, everything had power, and you didn't always know who or what power a person had. You know, you had songs that protected you, songs that were good, and if somebody hurt you or did something, the songs would get after you. Physical warfare was considered by us to be the lowest form of warfare, because it would only indicate you had no spiritual power. One of the things is there was the Walapu who could turn into, they were shapeshifters. They could turn into these animals sometimes with horns and kind of a mixture between a human and an animal, and they could run along. And we never knew quite who they were, so you respected everybody. The most powerful of the shapeshifters, incidentally, here were the human bears, women who could turn in to grizzly bears. And that's virtually why, Galit, there wasn't rape or anything here, because you never knew what kinds of special powers a woman had. And so you respected the power. It wasn't just physical or gender-based. It was, again, so much more. And these stories, these shapeshifters, reminded us of this. Now, you might say to me, well, is that really true? Did that really happen? Well, I'll answer you with what the old medicine woman who I knew as a young boy told me when I asked the same question. And she said, whether you believe it or not, it's true.
Uh-huh. I like it. In one story, a character grows very old. And in another story, a character gets to live forever. But the answer woman says it doesn't matter, because in both stories, they live forever as long as we remember them. That's really the meaning of this book, isn't it?
It's exactly right. And I would be so grand and presumptuous, Galit, to say that isn't that the magic of all our cultures and sacred texts? To remember who we are, and of all good literature, that it lives forever, that
Absolutely.
It is the guide that keeps us, reminds us who we are and what the important lessons of life are to learn and to be continued to be taught. I think that's the definition of literature, our sacred texts, and everything. As humans, we don't have great wings or claws or anything. The only thing we have is language and words, stories. Let them be good stories. Bad stories kill people. Bad stories create wars. Let's have good stories that doctor and heal. We need those. And by the way, the best of our sacred texts, from the Torah to anything else, are all about lessons, the right way to live with one another.
That is so true. I have one more question. What are you writing next? What are you working on next?
Well, we kind of touched it already. The title is The Last Human Bear, Her True Life Story. It's a big, long novel about an American Indian woman in California, a California Indian woman, who's haunted by the legacy that her stepmother leaves her, even as she negotiates the 20th century in Sonoma County, California.
Wow, it sounds riveting. I'm excited about it. Keep me posted. And Greg Saras, thank you so much for joining me today. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for having me. I truly appreciate it. Everyone, keep reading.
And thank you for joining me. Again, this is J.P. Gottlieb, author of the Whipped and Sipped Mystery Series and host for New Books in Literature, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Today, I've been talking to author Greg Saras, university professor and tribal leader, about his latest collection of stories, the forgetters. Hope you all have a yummy book to cuddle up with tonight, and always, happy reading.